This is Mame Warren. Today is the 31st of October, 1996. I'm in Tuscaloosa, Alabama with Jack Warner. And I want to know how an Alabama guy got all the way to Virginia to go to college. Why Washington and Lee?
Well, I went to Culver, the prep school, and my roommate at Culver was Billy Buxton from Memphis, Tennessee. And his older brother, Stuart, was a W&L student our senior year at Culver. And he's the one that interested me in Washington and Lee. I think kids oftentimes go where their friend goes. And in this case, that's what brought me to W&L.
So
I also wasn't in the top 20% of my class. I wasn't going to an Ivy League school. This was during the Depression.
Well, you know, that intrigues me that you were at Washington and Lee during the Depression.
Towards the end of the, yeah, right up there.
What was Lexington like when you got there?
Well, it was wonderful. We all stayed in the freshman dorm, and Billy and myself, of course, roomed together. Lexington, to me, was kind of a Arcadian dream. You know, it really was.
Tell me what you mean.
Like Thomas Jefferson, you know. I, too, have been to Arcadia. You know, we should all be plowmen and all that sort of thing and stick to agriculture. And it was kind of a place out of the mainstream, kind of I wouldn't say utopian, but it certainly wasn't that. But it was a place that, you know, kind of like a Broadway play that was Finian's Rainbow or something, kind of a place, kind of a dream world in a way. It was all male. It was just a very unique college. Different.
Why do you think that was? What made it different?
Well, the beauty of it, for one thing, is the most beautiful little college campus in the world. There's nothing to me that can touch it.
Can you remember your first impressions when you first walked on campus?
Yes. I was awed with the beauty of the colonnade. It's awe-inspiring. With Washington perched on top of the middle building. It was a beautiful sight. I still think it is the most beautiful campus. University of Alabama is the greatest, most beautiful state campus, I think. And it really is. But it doesn't compare with just the pristine beauty of Washington and Lee, in the fall especially, when the leaves are falling. Beautiful. And House Mountain. The air was always refreshing. No pollution.
How did you first arrive in Lexington?
In an automobile.
You drove?
Well, somebody drove me.
Uh-huh.
Freshmen couldn't have cars, you know. You couldn't have a car when you were a freshman. Although Billy Buxton and myself did have one at one time. I'll never forget that either.
Oh, tell me what you mean.
Well, we bought a Robin Egg Blue used car for $60. We weren't supposed to have one. And we drove to, I think it was Randolph, Macon. And on the way back, we had a wreck. I wasn't driving. Billy was driving. It wasn't his fault because the car just came out right in front of us. And it was kind of like a circus. Ringling Brothers Circus when all the clowns get out of the car. Maybe we shouldn't put this on tape.
Oh, tell me. This is great. This is what I'm after.
And there were black people. And and about 10 of them, got, or maybe 12, maybe 15. How they got packed in that car, I don't know. But they all got out. And they, I remember they ran across the cornfield, cotton patch, or whatever. And of course, that revealed the fact that we did have a car, because they recorded the wreck. And the president, Dr. Gaines, asked us to the house to see him. And we sat on the couch and we were very nervous. And he came in, sat down, talked to us. Why did you get it? And all that. And when he finished, what he said, well, boys, he said, I'm going to let you go this time. He said, if you do it again, he said, Billy, you'll take the slow train back to Memphis, and Jack, you'll take the slow train back to Tuscaloosa. And that was all that was ever said about it. Yeah, I remember that.
I'll bet that was memorable. Well, you know, this is a theme I always like to ask people about, and since you've brought it up, well, let's go right to it. There were a lot of women's colleges around Washington, well, you still are.
Yeah, and that was one of my, the downfall, really, because I like to go to the ladies' schools on weekends, especially.
Well, were they
probably called? Frequented those places. Too much.
Were they called road trips back then? Did you call that going on a road
trip? Well,
when
you were allowed to have a car, I had one. And in those days, if you had a car, you were very popular. Nowadays, I got the feeling that the little boys or the gentlemen that have the cars are not so. Are rather envied and maybe put down a little bit, but in those days, you were a very popular fellow. We really didn't know the difference between, let's say, a young man from a wealthy background or a young man from a poor one. We really didn't know. Didn't make any difference to anybody. Nobody ever bothered about, you know, where we came from or whether we were on scholarship. I remember Tom Christopher, who later became dean of the law school at the University of Alabama. We used to charge, if you had a car, you would charge a young gentleman that wanted to go with you. You'd charge him to help pay for the gas, and everything was 50 cents. And poor old Tom, he smoked a pipe. And he didn't have the 50. He was on scholarship. And he didn't most generally have the 50 cents. And we talk about it to this day. Tom says we didn't know where anybody was. But I remember Tom would reach down. He had to reach down deep to get that 50 cents. He'd clamp down on that old pipe of his and finally come up with it. I wouldn't let him off. I made him pay.
And tell me what he got for his 50 cents.
He got a ride to the girls' school and he had a date. He got a ride back, 25 cents each direction. See.
So what happened when you went visiting the ladies' schools? What?
Well, it depended on the school. Some of them you just sit in the parlor.
Take me to each one. Which one? What happened at each one?
Well, Sweetbriar was Randolph-Macon was kind of a little more restrictive than Sweetbriar. Well, there wasn't any way you could get in too much trouble in Sweetbriar. I mean, it was just there, you know, and you could go out, have a beer or something sometimes, but the little girls' schools in Washington, I remember you'd have to sit in the parlor and you couldn't leave. You couldn't leave the house, so there wasn't much fun going there, but Sweetbriar, I married a Sweetbriar girl. Bob Abbott. He was a football player, and I was trying to play football at the time. When I met Elizabeth, I wasn't on scholarship or anything, and we'd get the devil beat out of us most every Saturday, so I decided that wasn't for me. But anyway, it was a blind date, and she was going to Sweetbriar. I think it was much more exciting than at fancy dress. It's, just like a girl with her dress on is much more exciting than a nude. You know what I mean? I mean, you saw the girls on the weekend. You weren't with them all the time. And it made the fancy dress much more exciting, the spring dance much more exciting, because the girls were much more excited, because they got invited, and the costume and everything, and they would stay in the houses in Lexington. And it was fun. I think much more fun than going to class with them all the time. Familiarity breeds contempt sometimes.
Now, tell me about, did being there in the Depression, do you think there was any sense that that put a damper on anything?
No. Made it more fun.
Tell me about that. Why?
Well, I think that's true of the Depression all around. I was talking to some employees not too long ago, retired ones, and they'd say, "Jack, remember Mother would send me out to the paper mill that was here, and I'd work on the shipping gang. We'd work 12 hours a day, And the man said, "Remember working on the shipping gang, and you came out and everything?" And he talked about retiring, and I said, "Well, how is it?" And he said, "Well, Jack," he said, "back then," he said, "we didn't have anything. You could get a meal for 35 cents at the paper mill cafe with a great big bottle of knee-high pop and all kinds of food, stacked high." He said, "We didn't have anything." And he said, "Now I'm retired." He says, "I own my own home. And we worked hard, 12 hours. And he said, "We were all so happy. For 5 cents, well, you could buy a great big Milky Way that would choke a horse. Today you get a little tiny one, you pay maybe 70 cents or 75 cents for." He said, "To tell you the truth, Jack," he says, "in my retirement, I own my own home, and you're paying my retirement, which is very generous and adequate." He says, "And I'm just miserable as hell." Yeah. So during the Depression, I think in colleges and everywhere, people were happy. Nobody at W&L envied anybody else. There wasn't any such thing as envy in the way of the students. It was a happy existence. There were fraternities, but anybody could get in a fraternity that wanted to.
Were you in a fraternity?
Oh, yeah, I was in one. Most everybody was, if they wanted to. I mean, just the ones that didn't want to be were not. Or maybe, I don't know, couldn't afford it. Some of the kids working in the hashery where they give you your food sometimes or wherever, but nobody thought anything about it. And actually, being in a fraternity at Washington and Lee is different than being in a fraternity at Alabama. It's kind of a status symbol in your big state institutions, You ask anybody that goes to one of those state institutions, and it's a strange thing. They all want to know what fraternity you were in. Kind of like India, with a class society, you were such and such. Well, that was a lowly fraternity. Or you were such and such, and that was... Oh, you were the nicest fraternity in the college. Well, at W&L, your friends were mostly not even in your own fraternity. I was an SAE, and my friends would be Sigma Chi's or something like that, you know. You spent more time in other fraternity houses than you did in your own. It wasn't a structured sort of a thing that it is in the bigger institutions. There was. I don't know what it is today in some of them.
So tell me what went on in fraternities in those days. What was it like?
Well, you ate in there.
and tell me about those meals in the fraternities.
SAE, they were just great.
Tell me about it.
Oh, God, you had spoon bread and you had hot dinners. Excellent food. In the SAE house, it was a panel dining room that was given in honor of a kid that got hurt in football. Heard he got killed, really. Sample boy from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And the family built the dining room. Oh, we thought we were the greatest. I guess you'd say we thought we were the cutest guys in town, but my goodness gracious, there were only about three of us that ever graduated. So I don't think we were quite as cute as we thought we were. But that was one thing WNL had, I think, was a variety of students, put it that way. Generally, you'd have students from other sections of the country. And they weren't all real bright students, you know, this SAT scores and everything. They weren't always up to the top of the SATs, but actually, it was kind of like L.K. Johnson told me at the graduation exercises when he was sitting next to me. He knew I was a C student. What did he say? He said, Jack, he said the A students would be working in the laboratories and corporate laboratories and research part of business or society. And he said, the B-plus students would be university professors. He says, the C students like you, Jack, will be the ones donating to the university.
Got that so right, didn't it?
I think it was wonderful that it was that way, because I don't know what it is. I remember Lee Bidgood, a professor here. I went to summer school one summer, and the business school's named after him, and he talked about the football player that was an All-American. Not an All-American, but he was playing at Harvard, and his daddy had been the famous Harvard football player. And he was talking about how students and everything and how the world turns out. And he said that the son was trying to be like his daddy. And so he'd tell the coach, he'd say, well, don't I block as good as my daddy did? He said, yes, you block as better than my daddy did. You block as better than your daddy did. Well, don't I tackle better than my daddy did? Yes, you tackle better than your daddy did. Well, don't I run better than he did? Yes, you run better than he did. And he said, well, then why am I not considered as good a player as my daddy was? I do all these things better. He said, well, it's just the fact you aren't. I suppose he meant he didn't have the killer instinct.
Mm-hmm.
When the game came, he could do all these things better, but he couldn't put it together. He didn't have that killer winning instinct. Well, I think that's true in college, because a lot of the young men I knew at WNL, and gosh, they were great ones, were not the brightest, And I think they overemphasized that. I kept telling them that when I was trustee at W&L. SAT scores are good, but there's five other factors that are just as important that they don't pay much attention to at all. I'm not so sure what those factors are, but you all better try to figure it out. Because we used to brag about the 4 years I was at W&L. Turned out, I think it was 7 college presidents and a Supreme Court guy, and a couple senators and 3 or 4 congressmen and all that, out of that little school was perfectly remarkable.
It is quite a record.
Yeah, you had Edgar Shannon, he was Virginia, and you had Huntley, whatever it was then. You had W&L, and you had University of Virginia, and you had Auburn with Harry Philpott, who was one of my best friends. I used to go to Auburn games with him. He made Auburn. He was a W&L guy and went to school with me. He used to go around all over Lexington and preach. And he went to Yale, and he and Polly, his wife, both got their PhD or whatever it is in divinity or preaching. They were preachers. But you had all kinds of people, and that was an experience in itself. You had poor kids and rich kids, and rich, extremely bright kids, and get by the skin of the teeth kids, and I don't know. It was a good environment because you learned what the world was like.
Well, I guess we should talk a little bit about the. That is supposedly what people go away to school for, is to learn. What about in the classroom? What was Washington and Lee like in the classroom? Were there any teachers who made a big difference to you?
Well, L.K. Johnson did. I didn't finish my thesis properly, and he made me come back and get it the next year. So when people ask me when I graduated, well, I always try to think of it that I was in a class of 40, but I guess, really, I'd have to say 41 because he made me come back, finish my thesis. And then I came back the next year and graduated. He was a great teacher.
Now what?
Probably the best. He was in the business school. He taught personnel management and factory management and all that sort of thing the way it was then.
Well, you learned something, didn't
you? Yeah, I learned something from him. He taught me a thing or two. He was very good, the best.
What was he like?
And that was the other thing about the teachers. I mean, the professors. I'm going to say something that's probably unpopular with the teaching profession, but the best professors were not always the ones that had all these degrees. I found that the ones that were had all the PhDs and all sometimes were bored in class. And talked over your head and kind of up in the clouds, where a guy like L.K. Johnson, I don't think he had all these real fancy degrees, but he could teach and taught well, which is often the case. And like the football story I told you about, lots of them could do things better than L.K., but they just weren't as good a teacher, that's all.
Now, one of the things, when I was trying to do some homework on you...
Yeah, well, don't do too much.
Well, you didn't make it easy, because you never sat down and got your portrait taken for the yearbook.
No, I never...
I don't even know what your major was. What did you major
business,
in?
Business, B.S. and commerce, we call it. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I was always that way. It was funny. I was on the board of Culver, too, and we had the best boxing team that ever existed there. We boxed at Annapolis Plebes and the Pittsburgh freshmen and University of Virginia freshmen and all that sort of thing, and we were just prep school kids, and we were good. But when it came time to get your picture taken, I was never in it for some reason. And I won. I was good in it. I was never in the team pictures. I don't know why. Well, we kind of had a, I don't know what it was.
I figured you must have been a real camera shy.
Yeah, well, I was usually gone running over to Sweetbriar or something when the picture day was. And they didn't even have a picture of me in the yearbook.
No, they didn't. You know, I heard that there was this thing between class of 40 and 41, but I said, well, he's not in here at all.
Yeah, you'd think I'd never attended.
Well, I did find you. They had to
go get a picture of me. I had one. My mother had one. I sent them.
Well, I
to
did
prove that I was in school. Well, they knew me, but as far as the yearbook and everything was concerned, I was never much in it. Never even.
Well, now your name did come up in the sports section.
Yeah, I used to. We won the Southern Conference championship in swimming.
Well, tell me about that.
Gil Meem and Farber and myself won Southern Conference relay team, medley relay, where one swam breaststroke and one backstroke and one freestyle. And it was in the VMI pool. We won the whole conference. Yeah, we were good in that. Then I wrestled at WNL. Never was beaten. It was Henry Brown, Farber, and myself. But I only wrestled my freshman year because I quit. Became enamored with a girlfriend. You know how that is. and I remember Archie Mathis. He was really upset with me because I wasn't wrestling. At that time, wrestling was a major sport at WNL. And I never wrestled. I boxed at Culver and swam. And then I swam and wrestled at WNL and played a little football freshman year. But, you know, after being in a military school for 4 years, which in those days, you know, you were scheduled by the numbers, and you never really had any freedom. And then to go to a school like WNL was quite a, in other words, just like turning the chickens loose. You scattered. You said, my God, you mean you're not even going to let me do what I want to do?
There's a lot of freedom at Washington.
Yeah, an awful lot in those days. I mean, you could do anything. I mean, it was just you. You were on your own. And I don't think that those of us that went to a military school like Culver, we weren't acclimated to that. And we went wild, in other words. And the kids that had been to public school, it was nothing particularly new to them. And also, you had no girls at Culver, whereas at WNL, in spite of the fact that you didn't have the girls that went to school, there was schools all around you, Mary Baldwin and Hollins and Sweetbriar and Randolph Macon, and they were just all around you. Weekends the girls we'd get together. And even during the week we'd sometimes go off to the girls' school. Which wasn't good for your studies. I think if I'd gone to school after World War II, I'd been much better. I'd probably gotten a much better education, although I think I got an education. Maybe not the best academic one due to my own failings, but otherwise, I think there's more to college than that. It's the camaraderie, which we certainly had at Washington Lee. You had more of it there than I think they couldn't have that camaraderie that we had today. I don't believe it's possible. You got co-ed. Still the best little school in the country, but it remained single sex. It might have been a little better. It would have been more unique, certainly.
Well, that fraternity system is still strong.
Is it?
It's still strong.
Well, what about the sorority system? Is it going pretty good?
Well, they're trying to get, they have the sororities in place, and they're trying now to get sorority houses so that the women have the same kind of socialization that the men do.
Well, maybe in the long run I was wrong when I thought they shouldn't have co-ed.
Let's talk
maybe
about
that. Maybe it was inevitable. I don't know. But, you know, W&L, they could have gone on and on because they were, they're not state supported. Look how long BMI lasted. They fought it every inch of the way, didn't they? I don't understand why the girl would want to go to BMI anyway. They sleep on the floor on a mat. God almighty. They
want to go. Let's go back. Let's go back 15 years ago. Tell me about your opposition to co-education.
Well, just what I'm telling you now.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a place in little universities like W&L today where you can have a choice of single-sex education if you so choose. I mean, why not have a place where you got that? The girls' schools have it. You had plenty of female companionship and interaction, even more so than it was much more exciting. And a school could be different and unique, and with a smaller school like Washington and Lee, being unique and different, I think would have kept it a couple notches above what it is today. Now, the Ivy League today, I mean, I think we were just trying to, you know, the alumni and the students were 85% my way of thinking. It was just the faculty and the president that felt that we should have co-eds. The alumni certainly didn't. And it was even till the last minute, and then they decided to cave in. We had it by one vote, but a couple of them went back on what they indicated they would do. But, you know, they had pressure from the president and all. I think it could have been a more unique school, remaining the way it was. I still do. Look what happened to the Ivy League schools, especially the women's colleges. Vassar. You don't ever hear about Vassar much anymore. It's kind of sad. Now, Wabash, I think, isn't that college? It's still single sex. There's a couple, two or three of them left. And you know more about them now than you did when there were lots of single sex colleges. It would have been unique and different. And I think they lost a lot of camaraderie by going co-ed. And I think they've proven, for instance, that the ladies going to school in ladies' schools of single sex, that they're obviously producing a better product than they do if they let the boys come in, or the men. They've proven that. The girls that graduate from women's colleges assume more responsibility, for instance. The same thing could have been with men. The presidents of the classes and everything are women. They get more mixed up in politics. When they graduate, they're more unique, and per capita do a better job. I bet you W&L today, I doubt if W&L today will produce per capita. We had less than 1,000 students when I was going to school. They'll never produce like in my time at W&L, they'll never produce those 7 presidents and 4 governors. Of course, don't hold me to the numbers, but generally speaking like that. A couple of senators and a guy on the Supreme Court, or at least in the federal positions, and occupy high positions per capita. I don't think that they'll ever be able to do that on a per capita basis that they did in those days. I don't think it's possible. The other thing is, when it comes to donations to the school, I don't care what you say, the girls, the ladies, when you go around and solicit money, I know this is the case at state universities where they've been co-ed all along, the women are not going to be able to donate or support the college to the basis that men do. Some of them get rich husbands that help, but they'll give pin money. And for per capita, they're at a disadvantage there. I think they could have remained single sex and been unique and different. And smaller schools have to be unique and different to survive. Now, my great-grandparents both went to Oberlin. My great-grandmother was, and that was the first co-ed school in the United States. And she was in the first women's class.
Really?
And he graduated in 1831. You know, it was the Oberlin movement was an abolitionist movement. Mm-hmm. And her name was Drake, her last name, and she was the head of one of the underground stations running black people up to Canada.
Really? That's interesting.
So, really, I suppose my background would be co-ed. That was the first co-ed college in the United States. And it was a Congregationalist minister school. And he was a Congregationalist minister. Rode the circuit. I got his diary. He was converting the drunks and run the devil out of everywhere he went.
Well, I hope he was successful. So tell me how you felt when you got the news of how the vote had gone.
Well, I was disappointed, but I mean, after all, it's just something that happened, and maybe it was inevitable. Who am I to say it wasn't? Do you think that the women's colleges are all going to have to have men in them?
I don't know.
I hope not, but
I don't know.
I guess they will. But it's still a wonderful school, still the best.
What do you think now when you go back? What's it like for you to go back to your old alma mater?
Not the same. With all the girls floating around, no, it's not the same. I'd be telling you a story if I thought it was the same. It seems rather strange with all the little co-eds there, too. How many of them are there? 40%?
Mm-hmm.
40 to 60. Mm-hmm. 60 men and 40 girls. Well, my advocates of that sort of thing say that's healthy. Maybe it is. I don't know. No, I was disappointed, but I got over it. I send people to WNL all the time. And the ones I send seem to turn out real good.
So you got a pretty good record.
Yeah,
huh?
I got a real good record on the ones I've sent, or at least got interested in it. Those young men are really doing well. And WNL's doing well. I suppose there won't be any co-ed colleges. There's only two or three left, men.
Yeah, there are.
So maybe they were right, you know, getting a head start on them.
Well, let's get back to your student days. Did you participate in mock convention?
Yeah.
In 1904, tell me about that. I haven't talked to anybody who was there for your mock convention. Tell me about that.
For mine?
Well, in 1904, that would have been class of, yeah. The 1940s mock convention.
Well, I wasn't a very active participant, to tell you the truth.
Were you a delegate?
Yeah, we were delegates, but that was about all. I wasn't one of the ones that entered into the thing wholeheartedly.
Was it a big deal?
Yeah.
Was it a big event?
Yeah.
Well, what was it like back then? Or really, I haven't talked to anybody who did mock convention in that time.
Well,
period.
I think it was similar to what they're doing now, except probably wasn't hyped up to the degree it is now. You know, with TV and everything, and we didn't have that. But we had one.
Do you remember who you nominated?
I don't even remember.
Were you right? Do you remember? Were you right?
I don't even remember whether I was right. I was interested in other things. I think I went. That's about all.
I think.
In other words, you had to organize. You get somebody else to tell you about that mock convention.
Okay.
Because I wasn't active enough in it to really give you a really good idea.
Okay. All right.
You know, then you kind of took, well, some of us, you know, we thought that was maybe wasting our time. It wasn't, of course, but that was kind of an attitude. Like, for a while, people wouldn't go to football games, particularly at W&L, because, you know, it wasn't. Not like Alabama, my goodness, football wasn't that big a deal. And you'd rather on a Saturday have a date at Sweetbriar or somewhere like that than be going to the football game. Wilson Field wasn't exactly filled up with howling. University of Virginia was the big game, of course. That was exciting. It was a bonfire. And interesting. It was the big opponent. W&L has some good teams. I mean, they had four or five real good players on the teams. They just didn't, like your big colleges have three good teams and a lot of depth. What W&L have six kids on it, let's say, could make any team in the country, but that was all. They got tired quick. Yeah. Wrestling was really a bigger sport at W&L than football. W&L had great wrestling teams. Oklahoma was the only one that was in the same league as W&L. And it was a major sport, probably. You admired the wrestlers even more than the football players. I guess lacrosse is the big thing now, isn't it, or something like that.
It's a real big sport. But, you know, you're the first wrestler I've talked to.
Yeah, well, you ought to talk to Henry Brown. He was from Mexican, half German. You'd have to go to Mexico, I guess, to talk to him. Somebody told me that he has a fishing business where he takes tourists out and has a little fleet of fishing ships. Back then, his family made porcelain, I guess, you know. They had a factory of tile or stuff. Tile it was he made.
And
Ferrier, Barney, he was undefeated. All three of us were undefeated freshmen. I wrestled 165, and Ferrier was 175. I think Brown was Broun, kind of a German name. He was half Mexican, quick as a cat. And the wrestling coach, as I told you before, used to come over and get after me for not coming out for wrestling for varsity. But I didn't.
And did you get a good crowd at wrestling matches?
Yeah. And basketball. My God, basketball was bigger than football. My time. They were Southern Conference champions every year in those years. They had Spessard and had really good basketball teams. They were mostly ATOs, I remember that. Had the best basketball teams in the South. I've often wondered why W&L didn't try to get a basketball team now, because it's not complicated as football as far as giving a few scholarships. You could have a good basketball team. But if they had any kind of a team, I would think that try to compete, they could have a basketball team. It might be a good idea. Take that back, Lee.
Well, they'll be getting it.
Yeah.
I need to flip my tape over.